This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It is widely accepted Michigan has the largest Muslim population in the U.S. How did that come to be? When did those early Muslim settlers come to Michigan? Where'd they come from? And why Michigan? My next guest tackles these and many more questions in her new book, Old Islam in Detroit, Rediscovering the Muslim American Past. Sally Howell is an assistant professor of history and of Arab American studies at the University of Michigan, Dearborn. Welcome, Sally.
Great to be here. Thank you, Cynthia.
You say in your book, the early period of Muslim history in this country, in your words, is widely unknown to the American public and to Muslim Americans themselves. Why is this?
Well, it's because the Muslim community is one that keeps reinventing itself. And in the process of reinventing itself, very often the earlier history, the past, tends to be sort of neglected or forgotten or overwritten. And that's, in fact, as much the subject of my book as is the history itself, right? So why is it that things have been forgotten? And it's largely due to the fact that when new people come to America and when new people come to Islam as converts, they very often have this sense that what they're doing is something sort of new and that America is somehow a place that is new to Islam, right? So the fact that there are these American Muslims who have been here for a while, who've already established themselves, who are very comfortable and at home in America, that brushes up against what they think Islam is or what they think America is.
So there's all these forces at play.
All these forces at play.
Give us that sense of history. And when did Muslims first make their way to America in an appreciable number?
There are sort of two phases. The first phase was the early history of the United States, you know, the colonial era, the pre-national period, and the pre-Civil War period, when many Muslims, tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands, perhaps even more than that, came as slaves. A lot of the Muslims who came in from West Africa, in particular, were Muslim. So they brought Islam with them. Many of them tried to practice Islam, and there are wonderful records of their experience. But because of slavery and because it was difficult for people to, they didn't have the freedom to practice their religion, to marry co-religionists, to establish themselves, right? Islam, like the other religions that Africans brought with them, were mostly sort of killed off, basically, by the slave experience. But the second phase was started really in the late 19th, early 20th century, when immigrants started coming from what was the Ottoman Empire. They came from places like Albania and Bosnia. They came from Syria and Lebanon. They came from really Turkey itself, right? The country that is now Turkey. And these people came to work and they followed other immigrants from that period. And many of them made their way to Detroit, especially after the $5 work day from Henry Ford. And in fact, the first mosque that was built as a mosque in the United States of America was built one block away from the entrance of that Highland Park factory. It was called the Muslim Mosque of Highland Park. And it was created by Arabs, by Turks, by a few South Asians who worked together to establish Islam in Michigan.
So Michigan became the beacon, in a sense, because of Henry Ford's factories.
Exactly. I mean, there were Muslims in New York, there were Muslims in Chicago, but Detroit was really seen as being a center. All the missionaries came here, and a lot of the immigrants came here, too, because it had a reputation for being a Muslim space.
And when you say a reputation, a Muslim space, meaning welcoming, non-judgmental?
Well, it wasn't judgmental in the way people are judgmental today. There were stereotypes that Americans had about Muslims. In this period, in the teens and the 20s, a lot of Americans sort of thought of Islam, they associated it very much with polygamy, and they saw polygamy as being very problematic. So in fact, when you came to America in the period, you had to forswear polygamy. But they also associated it with the Armenian genocide. So if you were coming from Syria or places like that, people talked quite a bit about the Armenian genocide and represented Islam as being a faith that was sort of run by a tyrant, the caliph, and that Muslims were somehow anti-democratic in their practices and things like this. So a lot of the stereotypes that we hear today, we also heard back then, but in a different way, in a different way. And the Muslims who were here were very active in trying to counter those stereotypes. Perhaps their most successful way of doing so was just to establish communities.
Begin living. I'm speaking with Sally Howell, who's an assistant professor of history and Arab American studies at the University of Michigan, Dearborn. Her new book is Old Islam in Detroit, Rediscovering the Muslim American Past. As the 20th century wore on and more immigrants came, I'm wondering how Muslim identity changed as people came in and became a part of life in Detroit and in Southeast Michigan.
Again, there were different phases. In the early period, I think people were, like most immigrant communities are, very committed still to their homelands. And so we saw a lot of political activism in the teens and in the 20s in particular, where people from Africa, people from South Asia, people from the Middle East came together and they saw Islam as a means to counter the colonialism that was taking place in their homeland. So they fought against colonialism in Africa and Asia and the Middle East in particular. And there was a period when that was their focus. But you also had people who began bringing families here, especially the Syrian community brought their families, the Lebanese, Arab, Syrian community. And once you have American children, your goal really changes. Suddenly, your focus is no longer on things overseas. It's on how are you going to raise these kids as Muslims? How are you going to find them Muslim partners to marry? Things like this. Your kids are going to the public schools. There's no greater engine of Americanization than the public schools. And as people start to feel more at home here, they really settle in. And they developed mosques. In particular, some of the oldest mosques in Michigan were located in the south end of Dearborn, which is today where the oldest mosque in Michigan still exists, the American Muslim Society. And it's a very large mosque today, mostly a Yemeni mosque with thousands of people who come for Friday prayer, a very active, large mosque. But it was started by a small group of families who just wanted a place to teach their kids Arabic. And it started off as a one room. They didn't have enough money to build a whole building, so they just built like a square box. Everybody referred to it as the basement because it was halfway underground. And they worshiped there for about 20 years until they could add on a second floor and make it more of a formal mosque. But that mosque was, you know, it fit into a neighborhood. It fit into the landscape of the neighborhood very much in the same way that the other immigrants who lived in that neighborhood, the Romanians, the Italians, the Poles, all these groups had their own churches. And people went to them on Sunday and people started going to the mosque on Sunday because everybody worked on Friday. You couldn't necessarily get off work for Friday prayer. So people prayed on Sunday. The mosque very much functioned like the ethnic churches in the neighborhood did, and people even referred to it as our church. And other ethnic kids from the neighborhood would go to the mosque and eat when there was a meal at the mosque, and the Arab kids would go to the churches and eat when there was a meal at those churches. And it was the center of the social life of the community.
And then as new immigrants would come from the Middle East, would they look at the long-timers a bit askance?
Well, yeah. So, and this happened over and over again.
Yes.
So at the Dix Mosque in particular, there's a famous incident that took place there in the 1970s. So by the 1970s, again, this was just an American congregation. Probably the majority of the people who actually worshiped there were born in the U.S. And there were grandkids who were being raised in the mosque. And they had dances and sock hops at the mosque, right? The whole point of the mosque was to keep the community together. This was before Dearborn was an Arab town like it is today, where you could buy Arabic food in any grocery store, and there are tons of restaurants, and there are banquet facilities and things like this. The mosque was it for the community, and so people had to have their weddings in the mosque and their funerals in the mosque and their graduation celebrations in the mosque and things like this. And when people came from the Middle East, they would look at this mosque and say, wow, you know, we've never seen dances at a mosque before. Dances shouldn't be in a mosque. Or what are all these women doing here? There are many, many women in the mosque. They don't even have their heads covered. And also the people who started arriving, especially in the 1960s and 70s, they were politicized in a different period, right? They grew up in a Middle East that had been affected to a great extent by the Cold War, right? So there was a conflict between the United States and the Soviet Union, and their countries were all caught up in this. Many of them came from dictatorships and countries that had been sort of propped up by the United States, and they were tended to not be very friendly to Zionism. Mm-hmm. They were all very supportive of Palestinian rights. And this is, of course, after the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza Strip, which was traumatic for the region, to say the least. And so people came here and they felt a little bit at odds with America. Mm-hmm. And they had a much more conservative form of Islam they were practicing, a more modernist, a more rational type of Islam, less based just on experience and more based on interpretation and knowledge and things like this. And they were trying to live sort of very much as upright Muslims. And they came to America.
Letter of the law.
Letter of the law. And they came and they saw these American Muslims, the women with their heads uncovered, dances in the mosques, all these things that to them just looked American. They didn't look Muslim. Mm. And so they became concerned and they basically organized a coup, took over the board, took over the mosque, you know, told the women they had to cover their hair and put in their own Sunday school teachers and things like this. And this was, of course, traumatic for the founders of the mosque.
Basically being called out by
newcomers. Being called out, and they felt like they were kicked out, too.
Yes.
So they went and started a new mosque. It wound up okay. But the thing about this is we kind of are familiar with this happening in the 1960s and 70s. It kind of goes back further in time. So there's an imam who came to Detroit in the 1940s. Right. And he wasn't that different in the terms of the way he had been raised from the people around him. He was invited by a mosque, another mosque, which was right down the street from the Dix Mosque, that was called Hashemi Hall. And he was invited to be the imam of Hashemi Hall. And one of the first things he did when he got there was Hashemi Hall was in a renovated bank building. It wasn't in a building that looked like a mosque. Right. And he went in and he thought that was inadequate. And the first event he held in the mosque, he put a prayer rug down on the floor and he said, "I now declare this a mosque." And had a prayer in it. Well, the mosque had been a mosque for 12 years before he got there, you know. Yeah. So, and he also, a few weeks later, he had another party to create a Muslim school. And there was already a Muslim school there. So he actually got kicked out of town.
Right.
The people who built that institution said, "Hey, wait a minute. We don't need you to tell us that we're not enough of a mosque." You know, he eventually came back and he was the founder of the Islamic Center of America, the very large mosque that many people in Michigan are aware of that's on Ford Road. So there's, you know, there was a lot of push and pull. But together, people have created this very large, dynamic Muslim community that we see today.
What about the other side of the coin? Spell out for us the ways that the Muslim community has changed Southeast Michigan.
Well, so in the first place, they've just made it a more dynamic community in terms of faith, right? And you can practice Islam now in Detroit without even entering a mosque, right? There's halal food everywhere. Many of the public school systems close on Islamic holidays. Like I said, there are banquet halls. There is just a public space here that is open to Muslims and has been shaped by Muslims. So that's sort of the religious side of it. Now, obviously, Muslims have been here for 100 years or more now. And so there are people who helped build the cars. There are the people who helped engineer the cars. There are many Muslims who helped lay out the city, build the apartment buildings and all the housing in the city. The Arab community is famous for running the small groceries in the city for over 100 years. Different people have done it over time. Now the Lebanese have a sort of a monopoly on the gas station business in Detroit, you know. But Muslim Americans from a whole wide array of backgrounds. I mean, if you go to the mosques outside Hamtramck in the summertime, you see their parking lots filled with ice cream trucks. Right. So they're newly arrived people who are selling ice cream. That's the way they're getting their start. And then there are doctors and lawyers and engineers and people who run, you know, some of the state's biggest companies. And, you know, Muslims are running more and more for public office. So Muslims are just totally a part of the fabric of Michigan now.
Sally, what drew you to this field? You're a assistant professor of history and Arab American studies. You are not Muslim.
Not Arab either.
Yeah. What drew you to this field?
Well, I first came to Michigan when I was right out of college, and I had worked briefly in Washington with an Arab American organization there, and they recommended me to Ismail Ahmed, who was the director of Access at the time, and I was looking for a job. I was sort of between things, and Ish hired me to be the arts director at Access. And I will say, I really didn't know very much about local history or about, you know, Michigan history, Arab American history. And the thing that struck me about Dearborn, the thing that struck me that made it exotic and interesting to me and worthy of my real focus and attention wasn't the Arabness of Dearborn. I had lived in the Middle East before and done research there and gone to school there. So that it wasn't the Arabness. It was the working class nature of the city. I was just fascinated. I was right there working in the shadow of the Rouge plant. And in a neighborhood where, you know, where the UAW was really born in many ways. And it was those stories, right? And it was, of course, Arab Americans who were introducing me to this history. So that's really what got me started.
To many around Michigan and around the world, the face of Islam now is the man, for example, dubbed Jihadi John, the ISIS killer who's been front and center in these recent beheading videos. How do you reconcile the Islam that you have come to know through working and studying with the jihadist view that the world sees and is horrified by?
I can't reconcile those. They have nothing in common with one another. The people I work with in Michigan are, I mean, they're believing people. They're committed to their faith. They want to keep their faith alive and make it viable and vibrant and attractive to the next generation. That's their mission. That's their goal. They're also Americans, completely and fully, and they want to make our society a better place. as well for the next generation. And they're working very hard to do that on a whole variety of nonprofit organizations and charities that are trying to reinvent the city and things like that. But this this fanaticism that we see is a product of generations of underinvestment or misguided investment in the region by our government, by other governments. What we've imported or exported to the Middle East more than anything is our technologies of war. The experience of military occupation and violence there has traumatized people, clearly. And, yeah, I can't justify what people are doing. I wouldn't begin to. And I can't understand it, even as a person. But it's there. But it has so little to do with the people I work with that I just don't even – I don't need to be a specialist on those things, mm-hmm, right? Those mm-hmm. those are not what the people here in Michigan are about.
But to know that people who are not Muslim, they're looking at that and they immediately, you know that, are covering the entire community with that terrible blanket.
Yeah, well, that's part of what also makes it a challenge to be a Muslim American, right? So you're not just doing what other immigrant populations or other convert populations do, which is set about trying to establish yourself. You're establishing yourself with this stigma on your back and with this, you know, everyone's afraid of you. The government is spying on the community. It's really a cloud that hangs over people. And there's not a thing that takes place in the community that doesn't take place in relation to that cloud, right? It's so pervasive.
Through that filter,
the
yeah.
stereotypes. I mean, most of the students I teach at U of M Dearborn in my Arab American classes are Muslim Americans, right? And they understand that that what they do, if you're from a small minority community like this, every person represents the community, right? Everything you do somehow represents your community. You're not free to just go off and make mistakes. Whatever mistakes you make reflect back on the community. And this is a real burden and responsibility for people to have to bear, especially young people. But again, like I said, the way that Muslims are sort of coping with this is just to really invest in this society, right? To invest publicly, to, you know, try and make sure that other Americans can see, or they want to be visible, right? They can't be invisible. In the past, they might've chosen to be invisible. They can't be invisible anymore. So they want to be visible with all the positive things they're doing. That's really the only thing they can do to counter this.
Sally Howell is an assistant professor of history and Arab American studies at the University of Michigan, Dearborn. Her new book is Old Islam in Detroit, Rediscovering the Muslim American Past. Pleasure to talk with you. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Cindy.